I'll say from the north. Anyway, maybe there's somebody here from the north. But we're glad to see you all here, and we're glad to have our brother Michael especially here this evening to give us a lesson in one of the things in the Lord's Word that he feels can be profitable to us spiritually. I love Brother Michael. We've known each other for many, many, many years. We're formerly brother elders in the Los Angeles class, and I have a special feeling and a memory of wonderful times spent together. It's nice to see him up here in Portland. And we're going to turn the meeting over to him, and his topic for this evening is going to be on the seven deadly sins. Brother Michael.
Thank you, Brother David, and of course it is a pleasure to be here at the retirement center. There's a lot of people in this room that have known me for a lot of years, some even before I got married, and that was a really long time ago. And so it's great to be here with old friends. I bring you the Christian loving greetings of the brethren in Los Angeles. You would expect that. But I'm also bringing the Christian loving greetings of the brethren in Fresno, which you wouldn't expect. As it turned out, we were able to spend Saturday and Sunday in Fresno with the brethren there, and we actually drove here from Fresno, and they voted to have their love extended, and we are happy to do that. I want to also tell you that we are going to have a convention at the end of May, and there is now convention programs that have been put in the back where there are other convention programs. I don't know whose I had to cover up in order to display mine, but it really doesn't matter. And so that program is there. We know that not all of you can make it down for the convention, but for those of you that can, we are looking forward to a blessing from the Lord. I also wanted to tell you about something that you can avail yourself of. This book is now available. We have been waiting and waiting for it, and we now have it. It is called Deep Waters and a Bubbling Brook, and it is been compiled by, it's basically very short anecdotes that have appealed to the mind of Carl Hagensick, and it has been illustrated by Sister Shirley. And so this was announced in the pages of the Herald magazine. We've gotten a lot of orders for it, and there have been brethren that I've talked to here at the retirement center that didn't know anything about it. And then they opened it up and they sort of read one anecdote and they said, you know, I want one. And then I reached the point where I didn't have any anymore. And so now there is a supply of these and they are available. How did they go about getting it?
They will be in the back, $15.
All right, they're $15. And if you want one, I believe that it's fair to say you will not regret it if you get it. It is absolutely excellent, and it is now available. Get it while the supplies last, I think is the way it's said. I really don't know why I got attracted to the topic of the seven deadly sins. You know, there is a scripture in Proverbs, the sixth chapter, and Richard Beniac used it in a discourse of his. If it wasn't the last discourse, it was the one before that. And he quoted from it, and it's a list of sins. And it's like we're supposed to pay attention to the number, because in Proverbs 6:16, and I'm going to read it from a different translation. None of you have this translation, so I might as well not even tell you who it is. It's like we're supposed to pay attention to the number, because it starts out by saying, six things I will tell you, and I will name a seventh for good measure that the Lord hates and will never abide. So, you know, here's a list of seven sins that the Lord absolutely hates. And then here comes the list. A haughty look, lying tongue, hands that take innocent life, heart that ever devises thoughts of mischief, feet that hasten upon an ill errand, and the false witness whose every breath is perjury. And the seventh is the sower of strife among brethren. So it's like with a list, you know, here's your list of seven sins. Who needs some other list. Well, I don't know why they did this, but I went on the internet and said, you know, tell me all you know about the seven deadly sins. And I realized very soon that this is a very ancient list. And it doesn't seem to be changed as the centuries go by. I mean, with the 30 industrials on the Dow Jones, if a company goes bankrupt, they just add another one in, and it's still 30. Or if there's a merger, they bring another one in. It's always 30. It doesn't matter when you look at it, it's 30 industrials. But this list of seven that is there, it's always been seven. It's always been the same. And I guess people can remember things if they're numbered. Seven wonders of the ancient world, or a 12-step program, or 10 commandments. I mean, there's something about a numbered list that we all like. And maybe that's why they did this such a long, long time ago. We're talking second, third centuries in the gospel age, of when these lists were promulgated and discussed and talked about. Maybe the whole idea of having the list and talking about it is that then maybe people will do something about it. Now, it's always interesting when people who think they don't have faults discover that they have one. And, of course, it's especially disconcerting when you realize that it was a fault that you never liked to see in other people. You, of course, you had it yourself. One of the things that I've always been intrigued with is what Paul did in Romans, the 7th chapter, because he's talking about the fact that, you know, none of us can keep the law. And I bet you he was writing to people who thought, well, you know that's true with a lot of you, but I can. And so he goes through that list of 10 commandments, and he picks one commandment he knows for sure everybody, in fact, violates. And it's the sort of a thing that they can violate, and other people might not know, but their own conscience would convict them, which is why in Romans 7, verses 7 and 8, he talks about the one sin on the list that he knows he can get every one of his listeners on. So Romans 7, 7 and 8, and this is from Phillips. And he said, I should never have had sin brought home to me except for the law. Now, for example, I should never have felt guilty about the sin of coveting if I had not heard the law say, thou shalt not covet. But the sin in me, finding in the commandment an opportunity to express itself, stimulated all my covetous desires. And, of course, it did in all the minds of his listeners or his readers as well. A covet is one of those old-fashioned words. It's like nobody uses this word anymore. You don't see it much. I don't really see it at all. It carries the thought of a strong desire, especially a secret longing for something for which you have no right. In that respect, it's much like envy. Most of us, I think, would agree that we have secret longings, secret desires for things that we have no right. And so that's why I think it's a brilliant example in Romans 7. So is that the only sin that can be laid at our doorstep? Well, of course not. We have all seen people in our lives who claim to have great spirituality, and then who do evil things. How can this be? How can they simply ignore or rationalize their own behavior as they do? And not one of us is immune. Jeremiah 17:9. The prophet in Jeremiah 17:9 says, the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? There's the phrase, the blind spot that describes this ability to practice self-delusion. The phenomenon was beautifully illustrated in Matthew, the 7th chapter. This is the place where Jesus uses the metaphor about your terrific ability to see the faults in other people. And this is what he says in Matthew 7 and verse 3. And I'm going to use the Phillips translation again. And Jesus says, "Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye, and you fail to notice the plank in your own?" See, that's the blind spot. You see so clearly all the faults in other people, but you can't see your own. Of course, other people can see yours, is the way it works. Friends rarely tell us the things that we don't want to hear. I suppose that's what makes them our friends. And, of course, if they were to do so, we wouldn't believe them anyway. That's why conversations with people who dislike us can be so revealing. Our enemies have no reason whatsoever to shield us from our own failings. Maybe that's why we're supposed to love our enemies. They'll tell us the things that we don't want to hear. But if we don't hear them, there's nothing that we can do about it. Seven deadly sins. You can put them in any order that you like, but because we were discussing this when everybody was eating, I have to put gluttony as number one. So we're going to do gluttony first. I'll give you the list, and then we're going to talk about each of the seven. Gluttony, greed, envy, sloth, anger, lust, and pride. Those are the seven deadly sins, and they have always been the seven since the beginning of this list. Sometimes they'll play with the words slightly, but it's the same sin. These are not listed in one place in the Bible, but all seven are condemned from Genesis to Revelation. What's interesting about the seven sins in the Proverbs 6 list that we read are that these are sins that are committed against other people. Murder, for example. But these seven are different. These are seven sins that we commit against ourselves. And in that respect, there is quite a difference between the Proverbs list and this list. Not only do we commit these seven sins against ourselves, what is a big surprise is that when we commit them, it doesn't make us happier. In fact, it makes us even more miserable, which is a good reason for not committing them. So, sin number one, gluttony. Now, gluttony has been defined as excess in eating and drinking. Now, you would think, from the appearance of all of the men and women who model clothes, that in fact everyone would want to be thin, because that's the people that they have in newspapers and television. And yet the world is experiencing an epidemic of obesity. The World Health Organization estimates that the number of adults who are overweight or obese has now passed the 1 billion mark in the world. And why is that? Well, one theory is that mankind, throughout most of its history, has had to work really hard for its food. And if the clan killed an animal, everybody gorged on it because you really could not be sure when your next meal would be available. And so they would sort of eat that way because food was scarce. Now, in the world that we live in, where food is in abundance, those old habits are still there. And we eat like we didn't know where our next meal is coming from, except that there it is on the table the next day. And hence, there is this new problem that the world didn't have before called obesity. Most of us don't require much food. To waste it, either through overindulgence or a misplaced desire for food because it's rare or expensive, or even to withhold food from the needy so that we can have more for ourselves, these are all symptoms of gluttony. Amazingly, the critics of Jesus accused him of the sin of gluttony. And that's in Luke, the seventh chapter. In Luke, the seventh chapter, verses 33 and 34, Jesus quotes from his critics. I can almost see him doing this with a smile on his face, where he sort of takes their words and just throws it back at them. Luke 7, 33 and 34. He says, John the Baptist came and he didn't eat bread, he didn't drink wine. And what did you say? Well, you said, he has a devil. Now, the Son of Man comes, he eats, he drinks, and what do you say? A gluttonous man and a wine bibber. And I just have to picture the master with a smile on his face. I mean, it's like, there's no pleasing you guys. It doesn't really matter whether it's the one or the other. You know, it's not acceptable to you. But let's broaden our view. Broaden it away from food and drink. If you feel that you have a right to anything and everything because you can afford it, if you indulge your every whim, if you have no idea what moderation and self-restraint mean, you are guilty of the sin of gluttony. Now, typically those who suffer from this and from the other deadly sins don't see it in themselves. If you say, this particular sin is no big deal, you have successfully justified your own behavior to make sure that your conscience no longer condemns you. Number two, greed. Greed says, I only want my fair share. But in fact, it wants a lot more than that. Greed is typically associated with an excessive love of money or of power, and there can never be enough. Once we begin to indulge a tendency toward greed, it is never satisfied. Greed demands the credit, the praise for the work of others. Greed wants more than what a person needs or can use. And today, in the American society, modern day idolatry has become the worshiping of money. And our society encourages it. But they dare not encourage it by saying, in America, we worship money. No. They say financial success. They say the good life. They say economic security. And with these phrases, there's never enough. And consequently, especially I think the Americans, and more now in other countries, people work so hard in order to have more. Because when you have more, then you can buy more. Jude, this is verse 11, I'm not going to quote it, but Jude talks about ungodly men who ran after the error of Balaam for reward. Now Balaam, you know the story, was a prophet, living in a far country, comfortable, we would guess, presumably happy. Now he was probably famous. We would conclude that because a foreign king sends his emissaries so far in order to get this one prophet to leave his home and come this long distance and curse Israel. Because we've got a problem at our borders, and so we have to get the best. You know, and basically the king is going to pay a handsome commission to the prophet for this small service. And the prophet likes that idea. Balaam is told not to go, but he goes anyway. And the reason is that he has become completely blinded by his greed for the reward offered to him by the king. And that decision eventually cost him his life. If he had been content with such things as he had, and stayed at home, he would have lived. Greed at its worst can be observed in the legend of King Midas. Now, you all know about the Midas touch. This was a king who worshipped gold, and he was granted one wish. And that wish was that everything I touch turns to gold. And it was so. And soon this was a magnificent palace. The floors and the walls was gold. The outer gates were gold. And his daughter ran to him and she turned to gold. And when he tried to eat, the food turned to gold. And suddenly, the things that he thought were so valuable had no value whatsoever. So do you want the Midas touch? Gold should not really matter to you. The next one on the list is envy. Now, envy is a resentment of the advantages that others have, which is along with the desire to possess those same advantages yourself. This is the one sin that is completely under your control. This is not the fault of anybody else. It's not the devil made me do it. You have control of this one. It is so shameful a passion, you dare not admit it to anyone. But you can harbor it in your heart. Carried to an extreme, it is a desire for our own good, even if it means depriving others of what they have. Job chapter 5 and verse 2 talks about what envy does. Job 5:2, this translation is from the NIV. Resentment kills the fool. Envy slays the simple. Now that Hebrew word rendered envy, Strong's 7068, is a word that's in other contexts translated jealousy. If you have the power, you may decide to do what needs to be done to satisfy your envy. David took Bathsheba. Ahab murdered Naboth and took his vineyard. One of the first accounts of human interaction in the whole Bible is the experience of Cain and Abel. Cain envied his brother Abel, and so he killed him. Saul envies David and tries to kill him. But Jonathan, who was the one person whose interests were really threatened by David, loved him. But what do you do if you don't have the power to satisfy your envy? Although you might claim to have no envy at all, others might think differently when they hear you speak. I once heard jealousy described as drinking poison and then waiting for the other person to die. But it doesn't work that way. You are the one who dies, and you die every day. Do you have feelings of envy? If you do, don't tell us how unworthy others are for the good fortune that they are experiencing, and how much better it would be if you received those same favors. Unless you destroy those feelings, they will surely kill you. Our next sin is sloth. And there is a word you almost never hear today. And not that it doesn't exist. Laziness is what we call it today. But I guess in olden times they liked the word sloth. It means an aversion to work. There is a mammal that is called the sloth. I don't think, seen one. But according to what I read, it's a very slow-moving mammal. And so, therefore, it seems to be aptly named. Sloth works to deaden our spiritual senses, and it makes it more and more difficult to respond to God. In Proverbs, the 24th chapter and verse 30, there is a wonderful text that talks about the slothful, about how sloth enables a person, if indulged, to just drift off into a sleep of complacency. This is Proverbs 24, verses 30 to 34. And the wise man writes, "I went by the field of the slothful, and lo, it was grown over with thorns, and nettles had covered the face thereof. And then I saw, and I received instruction. Yet a little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to sleep, and so thy poverty shall come." Paul told the saints in Rome to love one another and be not slothful in business. That's Romans 12:11. Now, the NIV translates the Greek by saying, "Never be lacking in zeal." So you can see sort of the opposites there between sloth and, in this case, the opposite is zeal. Sloth is the sin that makes itself at home among the Laodiceans. In Revelation, the 3rd chapter, the verses are 15 and 16. We know about Laodicea. You know it by heart. Revelation 3, 15 and 16. "I know your works. You're neither cold nor hot, and so because you are lukewarm, neither cold nor hot, I will spew thee out of my mouth." Sloth is also in Matthew, the 25th chapter. This is the well-known parable of the talents. You know, we've got three servants, we give them things, and we basically say, you know, work with this. And, of course, we have the one who received the one talent. Matthew 25, verses 24 and 25, NIV. Then the man who had received the one talent came and he said, Master, I know you are a hard man. So I was afraid. And I went out and I hid your talent in the ground. Here is what belongs to you. There is sloth on its very face. Sloth was a problem in the church at Thessalonica. 2 Thessalonians 10. I've got 10, 11. I hope it's... I don't even know what the chapter is. In 2 Thessalonians somewhere, Paul wrote 3. It's 3. Oh, wonderful. For the next time. 2 Thessalonians 3, 10 and 11. New English. He says, during our stay with you, we laid down the rule. The man who will not work shall not eat. We mention this because we hear that some of your number are idling their time away, minding everybody's business but their own. That's a magnificent translation from the New English. Judas is an example of sloth. He wanted only what he saw as in his own best interest. He was not at all interested in activity for the master. Wasting time is like receiving the grace of God in vain. Laziness is condemned because then others have to do the work that we should be doing. It's like the sin of gluttony because it's a sin of waste. Indulging the sin of sloth makes it clear we cannot be trusted with more responsibility because we have been so unfaithful in what we have been given. I mean, would you, if you were the master, give this servant who returns your one talent to you any additional responsibility? Certainly not. More than just a problem because you're doing nothing, we have this proverb that says, the devil finds work for idle hands. And that shows why it's so important to be zealous in the work of the Lord. The next on the list is anger. And that's another sin of our own doing. Don't blame others for this. This is your fault when indulged. It's one of the most common and one of the most powerful of these sins. It serves no legitimate moral purpose, and once aroused, it gets easily out of control. Even though indulging in anger is never in our own self-interest, those who do it always think that their anger is justified. Anger overturns. Anger destroys. It never builds up. It never preserves. Anger makes everybody unhappy. Anger has been described as a love of justice which gets perverted into revenge and spite. Impatient with the faults of others is associated with anger. Of course, we should be impatient with our own faults, but few are. We justify our faults. We get angry over the faults of others. Kindness is the opposite of anger. It uses a tender approach with patience and with compassion. The greater the self-control, the less tendency there is toward anger. An angry person is out of control and will likely do things he'll regret later. Now, we mentioned Cain's feeling of envy toward his brother, because his brother had God's favor, he did not. Those feelings that he had, which started out being just like inside, where nobody could see them, soon became obvious. And they exhibit themselves in anger, because God speaks to Cain and he asks, according to the New American Standard, "Why are you angry?" But Cain thinks in this case his anger is justified. And so when the two boys are together in the field, he kills his brother. Has this made his situation better? Well, of course not. His situation is worse, and that is usually the case when those with no self-control take action. One who becomes angry usually tells himself how justified he is in having such feelings. Soon he thinks about how to get even, how to take revenge, how to make someone else really suffer. This is so common in the world. Brethren, don't you do it. Romans 12:19. The apostle in this letter to the Romans, chapter 12, verse 19, NIV. "If it is possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. Do not take revenge, my friends. Leave room for God's wrath." Verse 21. "Do not be overcome by evil. Overcome evil with good." Two more to go. Next is lust. Now, the word means to have an intense or obsessive desire for something, and it usually, in our language, has a sexual content associated with it, context with it. And like the other sins, it is essentially voluntary and completely under our control. And we have examples throughout the scriptures that show this. The men of Sodom lusted, it says, over these guests. We have David's lust for Bathsheba. We have, later on, his son Amnon's lust for his half-sister Tamar, 2 Samuel 13. But there are other lusts. There's the lust for power. Perhaps the best example of indulging that sin is Jezebel. Jezebel stands out as a woman who would do anything to get power and then do whatever she has to do to keep it. 1 Corinthians 10, verse 6. Paul writes in 1 Corinthians 10, 6, "These things," referring to these Old Testament experiences, "were our examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted." Verse 11. "Now all these things happened unto them for ensamples." And in the margins of King James Bibles, you'll see the word types. Types. "They are written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the world are come." In Numbers, the 11th chapter, we have an example of Israel who were lusting after evil things. The account is in Numbers 11. The verses are 4, 5, and 6. This was a mixed multitude that had come out of Egypt. Numbers 11, 4. "And the mixed multitude that was among them fell a lusting. And the children of Israel wept, and they said, Who shall give us flesh to eat? We remember the fish which we did eat in Egypt freely. The cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, and of course the garlic. But now our soul is dried away. There is nothing at all, well, of course, except for this manna. Wasn't it great when we were in Egypt compared to where we are now? See, nostalgia has kicked in. It works its magic, and the people can't remember those evil taskmasters that work their fingers to the bone from morning till night. All they can remember is how great we had it in Egypt and how awful we have it now. Do we have nostalgia for the things that are forbidden? Do we tire of the same old manna day after day? Ingratitude of any kind is sad to see. But the Lord may permit you to indulge your ingratitude if you have your mind set on it. They said, "Who will give us flesh to eat?" And the Lord sent the quails. And the quails came, and the people filled their bellies with them, and then the plague followed. And we read that there they buried, quote, the people that lusted. That's verse 34. Lust is the self-destructive drive for pleasure that is way out of proportion to its worth. Sex, power, image, anything can get so badly out of control. But self-control, self-mastery prevent pleasure from killing the soul by suffocating it, which is exactly what lust does. The last, pride. That's the only one of the seven sins that made the list in Proverbs 6. Because I think the phrase in Proverbs 6 was haughty eyes. You know, it's like, what are haughty eyes? Well, that's a euphemism for pride. That is, I'm better than you, is the idea. So pride is on the list, on both of these lists. Pride feeds all the other deadly sins. Pride makes you think that you are the most important. And thus you believe that gluttony and greed and lust are legitimate ways to satisfy your needs, regardless what it does to other people. If you think that you are important, then envy tells you that you deserve what other people have. Important people don't have to work. And since you are important, sloth is encouraged. And those who disagree with you certainly deserve your anger. It has been said that temper gets us into trouble and pride keeps us there. The irony is that indulging pride almost always makes one miserable. I'm going to ask you to picture in your mind's eye somebody, it can be a real person or not, who, in your opinion, is focused only on himself. That's all that matters to this person. He cares about his needs, his wants, his rights. Probably quite concerned about plastic surgery, hair implants, Botox, whatever delivers the right image. Got it? Is that a happy person? My guess is it is not. Next exercise. Erase the mind. Now I want you to picture somebody in your mind, real person or not, who, in your opinion, is really happy. Okay, so if you got that? Somebody that, in your opinion, is really happy. Why is that person happy? My guess is that the likelihood is that person is paying much more attention to others than he or she is paying to himself. Isn't that an interesting irony in all of this? You feed these things, the things you can control, and they don't make you happy, they make you miserable. And yet look at around you for these counterexamples. If happiness is what you want, then think about those that are, in fact, focused on others. They are happy. When a person wants to be important or attractive to others, there is an excessive love of self. And that's why pride is so hated by God. God should be the object of our love because of the grace He has given to us. Excessive love for ourselves corrupts our relationship with God because it replaces God with self. The seven deadly sins have also been called carnal sins. Carnal is a word that means flesh. Paul equates carnality with death. And he does that in Romans, the 8th chapter. So when you see the word carnal, think flesh. Romans 8, 6 and 7. And Paul writes in his letter, to be carnally minded is death. But to be spiritually minded is life and peace. The carnal mind is enmity with God. Each of these seven deadly sins can be fought with seven key virtues. Moderation defeats gluttony. Generosity defeats greed. Contentment defeats envy. Zeal defeats sloth. Kindness defeats anger. Purity defeats lust. And humility defeats pride. But you don't have to memorize seven antidotes so that you can go forth and do battle against the seven sins. Take responsibility for your own behavior and exercise more self-control. In Proverbs 16:32, a contrast between the one that the world thinks is so great and so important. But the wise man says in Proverbs 16:32, he that is slow to anger is better than the mighty. And he that ruleth his spirit is better than the one that takes a city. The one that rules his spirit is the one who is self-controlled. 1 Corinthians 9 verses 26 and 27. This is the NIV of 1 Corinthians 9, 26. Paul says, therefore I do not run like a man who is running aimlessly. I do not fight like a man doing shadow boxing. No, I beat my body. I make it my slave so that after I have preached to others, I myself will not be disqualified from the prize. May the Lord give us the strength to bring every desire into subjection to His will so that we all might be found faithful even unto death. Amen.
Well, thank you very much, Brother Michael, for those thoughts to think about. I'm sure we all have much to consider as to the difference between what's pleasing to God and what is not. It was a lesson which helps us to examine ourselves, and I think that's the importance of our gathering together, is to benefit from our gathering together to put together the good things that are discussed at our meetings amongst ourselves, and we see the example of others who are serving the Lord faithfully. Brother Michael brought the love of the Los Angeles class. I think it would be nice if we sent the love of this class back to Los Angeles with Brother Michael. And then I think there are many here who are visitors that might have love that they would like to bring from their ecclesias. Sister Diane?
Brother David, the Jersey City Ecclesia of New Jersey sounds
especially. The Jersey City class in New Jersey extends his love to all of us. Anyone else? Our Brother Tim, and then Brother Eniac.
Brother David, the brethren in Albuquerque asked me to send their love to all of you, especially Sandy's father, Brother Rick Buss. He said, make sure and give all my love to the brethren in the BSRC. And last Saturday, I spoke to Sister Hava Bausch in Israel, and I mentioned I was coming up here, and she also wanted to be remembered to all of you here. And also on Saturday, I spoke to Sister Elva Lanowick. She just returned to Paradise from Florida. She's now living in Paradise, California, after 5 years in Florida, and she sends her love and greetings to the brethren here.
Thank you very much. From Albuquerque, Sister Bausch and Sister Elva. Brother Biniak.
I was commissioned by Brother Jerry Black to bring the love of Jerry and Judith Black and the Browns.
Okay, thank you very much. Sister Dawn up here.
I bring the love of the brethren in Rockland, New York. And also, Brother David asked me to give a little report on Brother Frank. And Brother Frank is failing. But Brother Frank and Sister Esther continue to appreciate very much the prayers of the brethren, and they do feel the strength from the Lord in this experience. Also, love from Russ. He is out here. He came in Monday night, and I was very thankful for that. But he is home. He's at home with his parents tonight.
Okay. Thank you very much, Brother Bob.
And Sister Donna sends her love to all the friends.
All right, thank you. Sister Ostrander sends love. Bob Wilson and Shirley Evans.
Brother Nakora brought the love of the Fresno Brethren, but I would mention that the Fresno Convention is coming up in about 7 weeks, the last day of March and the first couple of days of April. And I have programs. I don't know if there's any in the book table or not, but I'll look and see afterwards. And if not, I've got them if anyone wants one. But also, we stayed overnight Monday night with the Andersons, David and Darlene Anderson in Rogue River, and they asked to have their love brought to the brethren here, too.
All right, thank you very much. From Fresno and Rogue River, our Sister Shirley Evans.
Brother Carol Hagensack and myself have been exchanging emails. I sent my love to the, well, Richard's my love to the Chicago class, and Carol said, please convey Marge's and my love to the brethren there. Perhaps some of the brethren will remember us. And I sent him back an email. I said, Carol, all I have to do is mention your name, and everyone's face just lights up.
All right. Thank you very much. Special love from Carol.
Just before we came here, the Tomes called and wanted Laird love sent to everybody.
Okay, thank you very much. That was a handle. Sister Lee?
Love from Sister Becky and Brother Nikolai Grugin.
Okay, thank you. Sister Sophie Rawson.
My son Douglas Rawson wants me to remember him to all the friends. He loves you all.
Love from Doug Rawson. Okay, thank you very much, Sophie. All right, Sister Margaret.
Love from Brother Dariush and also our daughter, Anya.
Okay, thank you very much. Love from Darius and Anya. Sister?
The Coopers and Hanleys from Boise class asked me to be sure to give their love to the class.
Okay, love from Boise. Thank you very much. All right, Sister Shirley wants a second chance, and then Brother Carlton.
Well, usually Sister Anya brings the love of her mother, and it's so nice having Sister Danuta with us.
Thank you very much. Who else did I? Oh, Brother Carlton, yes.
We bring you the love of the Kopchiks from Australia and Sid and Joan Jones of Selkirk, Manitoba.
Okay, thank you very much. Anyone else? Now, that's a lot of love from a lot of different places, and we're very happy to receive it, and I'm sure we'll want to send love back to all those who brought love from other places. Okay. And we're going to end up by singing hymn number 130. Hymn number 130. Close with prayer. Brother Michael.
Our dear Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy most holy name. As thy children, we come to thee in prayer to thank thee for the manifold blessings that each of us has received at thy hand, for the gift of life that we have, and for a knowledge of thee, and because of the sacrifice of thy dear Son, the opportunity we have to walk in newness of life before thee. Indeed, it is our prayer that we might be faithful to our covenant of sacrifice. Help us to stamp out all vestiges of sin in our life, that we might bring every thought, word, and action into conformity with thy will. For we know that if we are faithful unto death, we will have a share in blessing the entire world of mankind in the coming kingdom. We thank thee for the fellowship of our brethren here and for our brethren worldwide. We pray that thy blessing will be upon them, and especially upon those that are going through very difficult experiences at this time. May they feel thy presence near in their time of need. And now continue to be with us, and especially as we depart from this place, for we ask it all in Jesus' name. Amen.